The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Steve Austin Show. I'm coming to you from the main streets of Los Angeles, California right now. On my way to the grocery store to pick up some groceries with Hershey the Wonder Dog riding in the back seat. We had to leave the Broken Skull Ranch in South Texas to come back to Los Angeles to take care of some personal business. And we're going to be here for the next few days, maybe another week. I don't know when we're going to get back down to South Texas. And I tell you what, you got to do what you got to do. And one of the things is, man, the deer were just starting to run down at the ranch. Bucks are chasing does. We're finally starting to see some of our better deer. Hadn't had a real good cold front come in and knock some of the green off the leaves. It's still hard to see a lot of things. Not too many bucks coming to the corn, but nonetheless, man, I mean, we were starting to get hot and heavy over there. Me and Ted Fowler, 361, starting to see some pretty good deer, but nonetheless, here I am, sitting here at an intersection with my microphone, driving my vehicle, and people look at me like I'm crazy because I'm podcasting as I speak. Now, I got pulled over a couple of weeks ago here in Los Angeles for not having a hands-free device. I was talking on my speakerphone. So I think if I got pulled over right now, I would probably get a ticket because I got this damn microphone in my hand. So if I happen to see one of LA's finest, I'm going to put this damn microphone down and act like I ain't doing nothing but going to the store. I got my seatbelt on. I'm buckled up for safety. You know, they make these vehicles these days. You can't drive nowhere down the road without these damn things beeping like hell to get you to put your seatbelt on. And to all you people out there traveling on your Christmas holidays, if you have an older vehicle that don't beep like crazy to tell your seatbelt on, here I am in your ear telling you, buckle up for safety. There's all kinds of crazy people out on the road about this time, holiday season, and people are crazy enough, can't drive worth a damn, texting while they're on the damn road, and all kinds of stuff. Nobody's paying attention anymore. You look at any car going down the road. Somebody's talking on the phone. Hell, I'm talking on a microphone. What am I talking about? But I'm sitting here trying to give you a heads up. I'm trying to warn you of things to keep you safe on the holidays. What are you guys doing for the holidays, man? Y'all going somewhere? You traveling? I turned on the television the other day, and they had a clip of some footage from LAX, the Los Angeles airport, and it was an absolute madhouse over there. Everybody's leaving LA to go visit their loved ones on the Christmas holidays. We had to leave the Broken Skull Ranch to come back to this cluster muck of a city. Don't get me wrong, there's some really, really nice people that live out here in Los Angeles, and in and of itself, Los Angeles is a great town. But when you got to leave heaven, the middle of nowhere, the Broken Skull Ranch, the pride and jewel of South Texas, to come back to this thing when you ain't ready to, kind of a little bit of a culture shock. Hell, I was in the middle. I slow your ass down, you some damn people. I'm in an underground parking thing here to get some groceries with Hershey. And people drive like a bat out of hell. But anyway, when you leave the peace and solitude of that damn ranch and you come back to this damn hustle and bustle, I tell you what, man, I was just starting to kind of decompress down at the ranch, too. It took me over 3 weeks to relax and realize that, you know, I'm on a different schedule. It's a different mindset when you're down there on the ranch. Finally got into a groove, and now busted that groove, and now, man, I'm almost, don't know whether to crap or wind my watch since it's the family-friendly show. Nonetheless, improvise, overcome, adapt. Things happen. You got to take care of business, and that's what we're doing down here. Hey, man, Redneck Island is in full swing out there on CMT. Thirsty Thursdays, catch Redneck Island on CMT, channel 327, if you got DirecTV. And the toughest show on television, the Broken Skull Challenge, is coming back. Season 2 premieres January 4th on CMT. And we had some badass women, badass men coming down to the ranch to give it everything they got. And if you thought last year was a badass season, you're going to dig this season. And I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys think about this thing. I got some other projects in the work, too. And also, on a T-shirt front, man, if you go down to BrokenSkullRanch.com, click on the merch button, that'll take you over to ProWrestlingTees.com. All the shirts that I wore on last season's Broken Skull Challenge are on there. I guess what I'm going to do this year is I wore so many damn different shirts on this season of Broken Skull Challenge. Maybe I'll have a damn T-shirt of the week as I roll these things out. But we had some good designs turned in by some good artists. So I think you guys are going to dig some of the new shirts. And they're available at BrokenSkullRanch.com or Pro Wrestling Tees. Just look for the Steve Austin stuff. It ain't hard to find. I tell you what, see if I got any stores I was going to talk about here while I'm underneath this parking structure. Lady just pulled up beside me. Make sure she don't open her door and hit my door. I hate when people do that. The other day I parked somewhere. I was down in Hollywood. Well, I said the other day. It was about a month and a half ago. I parked somewhere down in Hollywood. And the car parked so close to my driver's side door, I actually had to enter from my passenger door. The son of a gun was 6 inches away from my door. Now, I don't know what this dumb idiot was thinking when he parked that damn close to my vehicle. I needed a shoehorn, a Jaws of Life, some KY jelly, anything to get me in my vehicle if I was going to try to use that side of my vehicle to enter from, which I always like to get in my vehicle from the driver's side door. It really sucks ass when you got to get in the passenger side, jump over a center console, and then slide beneath the steering wheel. It's a real pain in the ass. So when you're parking this holiday season, help a brother or sister out. Park your ass between the lines you're supposed to park at. And don't jam nobody up. I wish I would have had the time to sit there and wait to see who and why they parked beside me as close as they did. I would love to have just a conversation. I'm not talking about a come to Jesus meeting. I'm not talking about a beat down. I'm not talking about a fist fight. I just like to just look at them and point at the distance between the two cars and say, why? Why in God's name did you have to park so GD close to my vehicle? Is my vehicle a magnet for your vehicle? Can you not get away from it? The magnetic force drew you towards my car? Are you just that stupid and inconsiderate of a driver? Man, let me get back on my iPhone and dig my notes and see what else I was going to talk about on this open. Here's my shopping list. We came back to L.A., and we weren't expecting to come back to L.A., so I got to get some meat, which for me, that's going to be hamburger meat, lean. Going to be some chicken, organic spring mix to make salads with some red onions, Parmesan cheese, eggs, spaghetti. Blah, 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 blah. Y'all know the damn store. When you got to make a damn list when you go to the store. I've been hitting him with so many damn steel chairs. I don't know, you know, if I ain't got a list, you know, I'm just kind of cruising around, picking stuff off the damn aisles. And I'll tell you one thing. You know, guys, I would like to give you guys a little piece of advice. Don't ever go to the grocery store when you're starving. You'll buy all kinds of stuff. Eat you a big-ass meal, and then go to the store. Because if you go hungry, you'll buy anything and everything, and you'll get the munchies, and stuff will look good, and you'll be buying all kinds of stuff that all of a sudden you get back to the house, you're like, man, why'd I buy this? This is the last thing I need to be eating. Oh, man, I ain't got nothing in my damn iPhone notes. This iPhone 6 is starting to piss me off, man. I got to get me a better case for this damn thing. Because I've been reading stories about people sitting on these things because it's so thin and they've been bending them. So I always keep my iPhone in my back pocket when I'm walking down the road. But when I sit down, I pull it out of my back pocket because my big ass to squash anything. The last thing I need is an iPhone that's bent up like a pretzel and I can't use it. I really didn't even want to trade in my iPhone 4, but the sumbitch started to crap out on me. So, you know, you can't get caught out in the middle of nowhere without your damn phone in your hand because your phone's got your damn, every single thing you own is on your damn phone. I mean, from your numbers to your, it's everything. Your life's inside your phone. So I upgraded this iPhone 6. Man, it's all right. The camera is a little bit better, you know, but you know, it's not like I sit here and just take a bunch of selfies. And, well, as I call them, a picture of myself by myself. But, yeah, it's okay. I kind of feel like I'm carrying a purse when I carry this damn thing around. I think it's too big. I should have got an iPhone 5. But now I'm stuck with the damn 6, so, you know, what you going to do about it? Let me see what I got here, man. Family-friendly rundown. Man, I done told you guys about the Broken Skull Challenge coming up on January 4th. I done told you about Redneck Island. It's on every Thursday on CMT. And what else I got to tell you about? Man, that's all I got to tell you about. So let's go ahead and take care of a little bit of biznatch. And I got some other projects coming up I'll announce here pretty quick.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
When the moment for intimacy arrives, you need to be ready. Roman ready. Whether you've been in a relationship for years or you're just getting started, having the confidence that comes from preparation means you're free to enjoy the moment, when the moment comes. Even though you're far from ordinary, the truth is that ED is really common. In fact, 52% of guys age 40 to 70 experience some form of erectile dysfunction. Go to GetRoman.com/Austin now to speak with a U.S.-licensed healthcare professional about erectile dysfunction and get 15% off your first month of treatment. Roman's system is completely confidential and totally discreet. No big logos or labels on packages. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for erectile dysfunction, all from the comfort and privacy of your own home. A U.S.-licensed healthcare professional will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, then it ships to you free with two-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward, convenient, and discreet. Getting started is simple. Just go to GetRoman.com/Austin and complete an online visit. Take care of your ED without leaving your home. Complete an online visit today to connect with a U.S.-licensed healthcare professional and take care of it. Go to GetRoman.com/Austin today. And if you're prescribed, get $15 off your first month of ED treatment. Make sure you're ready to have confidence and control this summer. Roman ready.
All right, everybody, here we go. I'm sitting here talking to one of my favorite pro wrestlers of all time, Ivan Koloff. He's down there in North Carolina. I'm over here in Los Angeles, California. Had to come back and take care of some business. Ivan, you're one of my all-time favorites. I used to love you guys raising hell and doing your thing and beating everybody up, especially back in the NWA days. It's good to talk to you. How are you doing these days?
Great, yeah. I just got a few results of 50 years of being in the ring and part of the wrestling business, but I feel fortunate to be even here, you know, with all the crazy stuff I ended up doing during my career. And I guess for that reason alone, matter of fact, considering the years of wrestling and the crazy bumps off the top rope and everything, landing on tables and chairs, well, like a lot of the crazy stuff they're doing today, you know, Steve. You really appreciate it. You got to get hurt, you know, at times. And I know ankles, knees, back, shoulders, those were the years. But back in our time, we weren't able to take a lot of time off and heal up, you know. I was told one time that if I took time off, I'd have to figure on replacing me. Put yourself in that place. But,
that was the thing about the business, though, Ivan. I mean, you could never take yourself off the road or take yourself out of a storyline, because if you just told a promoter, hey, man, I'm kind of tired or I'm a little bit broke down, you're not going to make any money. And, you know, these days on a guaranteed contract, you know, guys are, you know, they'll still get paid. But back in my day, when I was off for about a year with my neck fusion, you know, I didn't get any pay during that entire year. So you know the system because you're around from way back in the day. With that being said, you know, when you first started dropping that knee off the top rope, did you think, you know, I guess, well, none of us ever think, hey, this is going to catch up with me down the road? Because I would imagine you're at about, what, 72 now?
72, yep.
Dropping that knee all those years, it's gonna take a toll on your body. How many surgeries have you had? Where are you at right now on a physical level?
Well, as far as surgeries, I haven't had many. Just like we were talking about the idea of being replaced, if you had to take time off like that, so I didn't take the time off. I had one shoulder, the right shoulder surgery on it. Because I ended up hitting the post down in Florida about a year before that, wrestling Dusty Rhodes, and hit it pretty hard. And it turned, you know, black and blue type thing, and let it go. It healed up something I thought all right. But found out about a year later that spurs had developed in there, and they had to go in because I couldn't lift it. Couldn't lift it over my head anymore, my arm. It was really a lot of pain, so it went in and cut it open, and I guess they cleaned the spurs out, and I know my shoulder's about a half inch or inch shorter now than the other one, but it took care of the business, as far as the injury, for, you know, maybe 50 years or so, and then it started acting up again, and I'm back to where I started from. Now, I exercise it a lot, you know, try to keep it going, but as far as lifting on my head, I restricted and behind my back on that right arm. The left arm, my shoulder's been torn, the rotary cuff, and never got a fix, the bicep broke, tricep broke, so that's, both shoulders need work now.
Well, you've got some herniated disc in your back as well.
Yeah, my back has been diagnosed with severe lumbar stenosis, which doctor says you need plates and screws and all that stuff. And but I've known some people went in and got that, some got staff and all that. So I had other people tell me, wait as long as you can. Matter of fact, even Bruno told me that you'll know when it's time to go in. He says, whenever you go for a walk and your legs give out and you fall down. I guess that happened to him, and he had to go in and get the surgery to his back. So far, I've not fallen down, so I figured I'll just keep going. I don't know how old you got to be old, but I figured that I'll wait as long as I can. But my left ankle's been broke four times. I got big spurs on that from coming off the top rope, and I think that's what it is. You break little bones landing wrong. I even came off the top and landed on the floor outside, and I see these guys today doing that, and I said, oh, man. Don't do that, you know.
But you were doing it way back in the day. Hey, Ivan, you know, you started off your career, you know, you're from Canada, and then you ultimately achieved the Russian gimmick, the Ivan Koloff gimmick, and it was golly, it was one of the Rougeaus that came up with that idea. But my point is, you've wrestled as a single, you've wrestled as a tag team for so long, and you had a tremendous run. Well, I thought in WWF, you know, when you beat Bruno Sammartino for the World Heavyweight title, I want to cover that in a minute, and then lost that title to Pedro Morales. But then, you know, later on down the road, you found yourself down in the Crockett territories. And that's where I remember, you know, your career so vividly. And, of course, then you teaming up with Nikita Koloff. And you were a very, very good tag team wrestler, but you were equally as good as a singles. What did you prefer?
You know, really, it didn't seem like it mattered to me. I liked both. And I ended up in tag having a lot of partners from the time of Minnesota.
Yep.
He teamed me up with the superstar Billy Graham. Florida, I was tag team with him, and New York, superstar Billy Graham. And I had the belts down here in the NWA with Ray Stevens and Crusher and Nikita. Different occasions, and Don Canoodle.
Yeah, but how was tagging up with superstar Billy Graham? Because you guys were two completely different workers. Billy was more of a showman, and you were more of a wrestler, you know, serious wrestler. And superstar is one of my favorites of all time, so I don't mean that as a disrespect to him. But how did you guys gel as a tag team?
We got along real good. I guess I just really respected and loved Billy for... You know, we ended up working out together in the weights, and he showed me a lot of stuff because he was a bodybuilder. And, of course, I was just trying to get big, and the idea of cutting up and all that, I never got involved in that or steroids, thank God. But, you know, he showed me a lot of stuff that really helped me as far as working out. And in the ring, even if it's to this day, he said, Ivan was a workhorse. I ended up chokeholding and doing my stuff, but Ivan would come in and bump all over the place. But that's what makes a team. Like, a lot of times it takes either both guys do it, and Billy was ideal because he had that body and he could pose and then play the chicken thing and run.
But you were never a chicken type heel. I mean, you brought up the steroids. Now, how early on back in the day did the steroids really become prevalent?
You know, I was trying to figure that out one day, and I know it was far back because I got my back hurt the first time in 73 when I was in Minnesota. They landed on a board that was out of place in a match, a superstar and myself against Wahoo and Billy Robinson, and ended up really hurt the bat. And they ended up, I took about 2 months off, and it came back, and but I was ambulatory traction, chiropractor and all that stuff. And it came back, but I ended up really hurt it at that time, and that slowed me down quite a bit as far as being able to perform, and I realized it. And then after that, I came into the Charlotte area, and I was fortunate enough to heal up enough, I guess, to... And Superstar had introduced me, even said, Ivan, for that back, if you take some of the steroids, what it's meant to do is help heal, you know, because the guys come back from the war and all that, they're anemic and all that, they give them certain ones to, I guess, get the body going again.
Right.
And I said, well, I don't know, maybe I could try a little bit, but I just found my, I had already been on prednisone for about 10 years because of a diagnosis of a situation that I had in my body of, they misdiagnosed me with TB way back in 73.
Wow.
And it turned out it was sarcoidosis, which they don't even sure to this day what it was, but the prednisone, taking that 5 milligram a day for 10 years, it went away. And consequently, I ended up telling Billy Graham that, and I said, man, what I need to do is maybe try it. I tried it, and it was no good, because this was before I even was on the prednisone. And I found that all of a sudden I was more hungry, and I was retaining fluid and all that, so I can't take that.
Yeah.
And he even offered the shots, you know, but I did go that route. Thank God I did, because I probably have other issues there now. But I think that was my first introduction. As far as other guys used, I know as far back as the 70s, I was in California for a while with Billy and Dave Draper and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Bet them, and, you know, I got to obviously do that they're taking some stuff, but I didn't know what, because you don't look like that unless you end up taking something, I guess. But I ended up staying away from it, and I'm glad I did.
But did you spend a lot of time in the gym, Ivan?
Yeah, I did. I ended up at first doing heavy weights and trying to bulk up. Once I bulked up, I stayed pretty well on that routine of heavy lifting. I noticed in the early 80s, I see a lot of guys seem like they're speeding up on TV and more action and all that. And I figured I lost the weight, so I started running in that. And I used to run about 3 miles a day. You know, that kept my weight down. I got my weight down, and I felt so good. I said, man, I got to keep doing this. But then after the lot of injuries started happening, but for a good 10 years there, I felt great, you know, that I kept the weight down by running.
Ivan, you wrote your book, Is That Wrestling Fake? The Bare Facts. And, you know, you were basically in the business 5-6 years. It was your second stint with WWF. All of a sudden, you find out you're going to beat Bruno Sammartino for the World Heavyweight title in Madison Square Garden. Who, you know, told you, Ivan, this is what we're going to do, and, you know, ran the angle by you?
Vince did. I ended up, first of all, getting contacted. I was in Hawaii coming back from Australia on a tour, and I had already wrestled Bruno and all that. And I got a call one day. I was at the gym there, and I got a call, and it was Pedro. And I had really known Pedro well or anything like that. I knew about him, but he said that, hey, Ivan, I got to meet with you. I'm on my way over here to Hawaii, and I want to get with you. And he says, Vince is sending me. He wanted me to talk to you. And that was the first introduction. I didn't know what it was all about. He just wanted me to call Vince. He said it would be something that was good. And
you're talking about Vince McMahon Sr.?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Senior. And I got on the phone with him, and that's what he told me. He said, like, you come back. And the idea was to come back for at least a year, like, you know, type of thing. And,
now, they picked you to take the title off Bruno, Ivan. Who else could they have chosen back then? Who other than yourself was hot or a viable heel that they could have possibly put that belt on other than you?
Man, for myself, I was pitching myself because I kind of figured, man, what a lucky guy to get picked for this, you know, to get the switch of the belt from Bruno, because Bruno was my hero type thing. And to this day, he was still keeping touch with me. You know, I really respected him over the years. And I really thought that I was surprised, really surprised. And as far as
who were the other hot heels, though?
Man, I right now I think, but I know there was a lot of guys out there that even later on they ended up switching with Stan Stasiak, right? He was out there, for example. But all the other guys, like, I mean, from Pedro right down to the superstar Billy Grant, the Ray Stevens, and all those guys. I mean, the Black Jacks, and I mean, you stop and think of it, you look at all the talent that's out there, let alone that was in the WWF at one time or another, but in other territories, you know, was great talent. And I guess the idea of the Russian and the way it was with the news and all this stuff, that they figured there'd be a lot of interest in that. And I just struck them at the right time, I suppose. And,
but you guys had good chemistry in the ring, and it looked like you guys enjoyed working with each other and almost similar styles.
Yeah. Got along real good with Bruno. I think because I respected him so much, and all the years that I was in there. And, Bruno, of course, was all business, and ended up. I think that maybe the size and everything had a lot to do with it. Because I remember that night I weighed in, I was 305, and Bruno was like 280 or something. And I said, "Damn, I'm bigger than Bruno," you know, type of thing. But I was really excited about it. I didn't look at it that way. And, it was just that I was really pleased, happy to.
I watched as much of that match as I could find on YouTube, and I was surprised at the amount of high spots that you guys were using, especially considering the year that match happened. And in the book, you talk about a double cross happens from the New York wrestling office after you won the title. What was the double cross?
Well, as far as not actually a double cross, I think that was when I went to the Charlotte area, the NWA, and then the IWA came in there, which was a competition to the Crockett and I guess to everybody. Because at that time, it looked like they were just coming into the Carolinas, and they approached me a few months after I got in the Carolinas, and they're treating me fine. It was just, they said, we'll give you double the money. And I figured wrestling was more like, you know, like a drugstore, two or three drugstores in the same block. Because I'm, you know, just, you know, you're just a freelance contractor. And so I just.
So it was more of a thing of being blackballed just because you jump promotions.
I think so, yeah. In a sense, you know, that that's what it was. But I didn't ever blame Vince or any of them. They didn't, they just did what they thought. And they really wanted me to come back to the to them, and I was actually supposed to. I was supposed to double cross the IWA at that show in New Jersey, and leave them and come over to Vince that night. And I just couldn't do it. I looked in the dressing room, and the boys were, you know, under contract there. And I figured I'm one of the guys that they're depending on here. If I leave and this thing pulls, then you know, I'm to blame for guys being out of the job, you know, said.
Right.
So I didn't go, probably it was a mistake, and I should have probably went for Vince, because he always treated me good, and even after that treated me good. It's just the idea that I felt bad about the boys, and I never went for it. I went ahead with the show, and consequently they ended up negotiating with me at that time, because when I first went with the IWA, it was a 6-month contract with the idea of a year after that, and they're negotiating at that time with me, and I understood that they were going to go for a year, and at least the same money, if not more, and they ended up, I guess, finding out about it, or I don't know. They just ended up sending me a telegram in a way that was it. They're going to let me go. So then I find myself now without work with them, and everybody else mad at me. So you can imagine, here you are trying to get booked, and I even went to Tennessee for a week there, right around that time, and then Bruiser finally used me, and then they started using me down in Florida, and St. Louis and all that. But for a while there, it looked like I got everybody mad at me for a while, but it wasn't an intentional thing. I was just, I guess, out of...
just out there trying to make a buck. Hey, let me ask you a question. Going back to the championship match in Madison Square Garden against Bruno, you win clean. You're finished. Knee drop off the top. He shot you into the turnbuckle charge. You stuck up a foot and then get up top, drop the knee on him. 1, 2, 3. The referee raises your hand. It looks like he's telling you to get out of the ring. And there was some there was some voiceover work that was put on top of the match, seemingly at a later date. They're talking about, oh, we got to get this guy out of here. There's too much heat. To me, it looked like there was shock. It was a very quiet arena. I didn't feel the heat because it wasn't a screw job finish. You beat the man fair and square right in the middle of the ring. Why did they present you with the belt inside the ring and give you your moment right then?
I really think it was because they felt that there was the people were too quiet. And I had felt the same thing before in Montreal and being hot, Ernie the Cat Ladler in a tag against the Rougeaus. They filled the ring up with chairs, and it went real quiet like that, and then they start throwing the chairs. So I picked up on it whenever the referee said, "Don't give it to you back in the dressing room." So I just did what they told me and left, and figured that that's what they're concerned about, that the people were not going to accept it. They're going to get mad because Bruno lost. It was one of those things. I just figured that, you know, the quality of the tape that you see there now that the people have seen on that match was just somebody, I understand, in the audience has filmed it.
Yes.
It wasn't being filmed, yeah, by the office or anything. So back then they didn't film everything.
Hey, what was the difference between working with a guy like Vince McMahon Sr. and the guys that were running Crockett Promotions? What was the difference between those two promotions, just as far as the way they operated?
Well, what I found that with Vince up there, he was the man that you went and talked to, Sr. And I appreciated that fact because you felt like you were going to get somewhere when you ended up talking to some. The office, you know, you had the situation, whatever it was, maybe a suggestion, or if you just had a beef or whatever, you just went right to Vince Sr. and you seen him every 3 weeks whenever we did the TV taping in Allentown or Reading or whatever, Hamburg or whatever it was at. And they ended up being able to pull Vince aside and talk to him, you know, just tell him and how you found him, what you had wrong, or whatever you want to suggest, or whatever like that. And to me, that made it a lot easier for me than a place like the NWA with the different territories. And you came in, you had the promoter, Jim Crockett, then you had a booker, George South or Dusty or whoever it was. In a situation like that, you went and talked to the booker rather than the promoter. And that was the guy that was in charge. It seemed like, ultimately, I guess, Crockett would override them if there was something he didn't like, if he knew about it, but they seemed like they had the rain when they were in there. And that made it a lot more feeling of security, I guess, whenever you're talking directly to the boss type thing or the owner. But I always got along good with the ball, as far as that goes, until I did something like that IWA thing there. And of course, after that, they're all right with it. They ended up having to come back. So,
but Ivan, what was your thoughts when, you know, Vince Jr. bought the territory from his dad, and, you know, this, of course, you know, Vince started off as Capital Wrestling Corporation or whatever it was in D.C. and moved to Stamford, Connecticut, and the New York office is what it was always referred to. You're working down the Crockett's, IWA, AWA. I mean, you're all over the place. You're where down in Florida. What were you thinking when Vince McMahon took over and started putting all the different territories out of business? All of the different places were drying up as options for you to go as a wrestler. Did that concern you? Because at the end of the day, 15 years ago, it was the Monday Night Wars. It was WCW, which was NWA, versus WWE. And so those were the only two places to go. And now there's only really one place to go, and that's WWE. But what were your thoughts when Vince started taking his guys into other territories? I know he rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. Vince has told me himself that he received a lot of death threats. You, as a wrestler, your options of places to go are drying up. What were your thoughts on that?
Actually, I did end up leaving altogether, and I didn't I knew that Vince was going to, or I heard that he was going to be buying out some of the territory, but I was still wrestling for the Crockett's. This is in the fall of 89, and they had changed bookers, I remember, and they ended up, George Scott came back in, and he ended up not having plans at the time. And when I heard that, because already they're telling me you have to drive to Atlanta to get your flight to go to Chicago or to Los Angeles. I guess they're trying to encourage the guys to move to Atlanta,
right.
Everybody. And there was no way I was going to do it. I had my home here and all that. So I left. Actually, I didn't leave with a notice or anything. I just left. I probably should have called Vince at that time, you know, see if I could be any help up there. But I guess I was at the point that I was just disgusted with the whole thing because, you know, I just went through a run with Nikita and the whole thing. And I even after that stayed, did a thing with the Russian assassins and everything was fine. And then all of a sudden, George Scott comes in and they're moving to all of Atlanta. I just quit. That day I just quit. When I heard that he was coming in and that, I just went home and stayed home. Like I said, I should have called Vince and seen if I could be any use up there. But at that time, I guess I'd been running around, like you're saying, flying to different territories from Florida to, you know, because the Crockett's were trying to go all over, just like Vince is just doing today. But did work out for a while there. I guess he was competing with Vince, but seeing after a while, it was like, well, I guess whenever I wasn't figured in, I figured it was time to go. So I just did. I didn't really.
When you're not figured in.
That, I was called back in 93 to go to Atlanta for a Legends thing with
right.
Rasky myself. But that was the only thing that I was ever called for. And never bothered calling Vince, and I should probably have done that at that time.
But when you're not figured in and you got to go elsewhere, man, you've been married for, what, 30 or 40 years?
Yeah, so.
So
right now, 33 years.
Okay, 33 years. Now, what was your wife's take on the business? Because, you know, I mean, you're always gone. You're always on the road. It's a life of a pro wrestler. And especially back in those days with so much more driving than flying. And you know, she was always there. I mean, but so she just accepted it. Hey, this is the way things work. And if we got to go, we got to go. And or would you leave and just go places by yourself and then come home when you could?
Yeah, that was about the way it was. Ended up just going for Florida, go down there, just stay there till the next move, whether it was back to Georgia, New York, or a trip to Japan or something. It really made it hard as far as any type of family life or anything like that, because I can remember going years, you might as well say, without even being able to come home. Like, you go right through Christmas and that because you'd have shows and everything, or you're on a trip to Japan or something. It had to be real hard on the situation at home, but
there's not too many guys, Ivan, in the business that have marriages that lasted 33 years. Congratulations on that.
Really? That's true. Really? Yeah, that's because
hey,
up with it again.
Hey, you had some interesting days on the road. I want to get to your life, your things now that you're doing, now that you've accepted Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, you're an ordained minister. But I wanted to talk about some of the wilder times with your time in the ring and on the road with Mad Dog Buzz Sawyer. I was a big fan of the Mad Dog. I was a kid growing up, and that guy would come out there on TV, and you think, oh, man, this guy really is crazy. He is the Mad Dog. But out of the ring and away from the ring, he was indeed a wild man. And you ended up kind of, I don't know where you started off with beer and graduated to other things. But I would imagine that when you were growing up on a farm in Canada, you'd never been exposed to a lot of alcohol and drugs. All of a sudden, you're in the wrestling business. You're right in the middle of it. You're a big star. You're in demand, and you're traveling. And you've got all the stress and all the downtime and the atmosphere. What was your foray into the drug scene? Because you got off into a pretty bad way.
Sure did. Yeah, I ended up with the injuries, of course, being put on painkillers, stuff to relax, sleeping pills and all this stuff. And I think that was in the early 70s, whenever I got hurt real bad at the back. And by the time the late 70s come, I graduated, of course, at home. When I was a kid, just to back up there, it was, you know, you worked hard. It was on the farm and you milked cows and by hand, you got the crop in and you did the whole thing. And, you know, once in a while, they'd have a little party. And if you were even a teenager or even younger than that, you're expected to work like a man. So you'd have to get together, and you're allowed to have a couple beers or a few beers and at home, and the party, they always had a fiddle player in or something, and the music going well. But that only happened like once a year or something, usually during the harvest time, after the harvest time. But so I knew that that wasn't something that should be doing all the time. But as a wrestler, I ended up right from the very start, like even the wrestling school and all this stuff, I ended up getting involved in it. And, matter of fact, as a teenager, getting into trouble with the law and all of this because I tried to create my own business. I thought I was back in the old West, I guess. I ended up doing some stuff the illegal that was cattle rustling, they called it. And because I was, instead of having a truck or doing it the old way with horseback and rope, we'd end up roping them, all right, my younger brother and I, but we'd pull them to the car or twist their tail, get them in the car. We'd end up taking a half a dozen of those cattle to the sale and selling them until we got caught about 6 months later. And as a kid, 17, just going on 18 years old, get caught with that, it was treated as a felony, and ended up going to prison for a while for that.
How much prison time did you do?
It was actually a 6 month sentence, but I did just about 5 months with good behavior and all that stuff.
Okay, now you're a kid growing up on a farm. All of a sudden, you're in prison. Was that your was that a wake up call for you as far as a life of crime? And not considering the drugs you're about to get into, but as a hey man, this is not for me. Jail is not for me.
No, that's right. Yeah, it definitely was. I really was scared to death, to say the very, very least, because you got 2,000 inmates and they're going gangs and everything, and they're going around stealing stuff, taking stuff off you by force and all that. My brother with me, and we had to stand up for each other. Sometimes I tell a couple of stories in my book and that, but that it was definitely scary. So after that, every time I'd start drinking too much or getting into any type of trouble, look like there was trouble, it cooled me off pretty quick because of the, what had happened before. But I ended up, we're kind of wild kids, like a lot of kids are whenever they get in teenager.
Yes.
We'd go down to have a few beers, my older brothers and I would get together. And I can recall one time coming out of a bar, and I was going to the wrestling school, and my older brother Roger with me, and he was good with his fist, and he ended up this tall guy, about 7 foot tall, was giving us a hard time outside the club. And I'd never seen anything like that in my life. My brother did a combination boxing move on him and hit that big guy with an uppercut, and he went right back with the guy, knocked him out cold. And it was situations like that happened 3 or 4 times that got me edgy into the wild crazy stuff, fighting bars and all that. But I never was a fighter and like that. I ended up, getting in situations like that to know enough anyway that I shouldn't be doing that. But whenever I was off wrestling later on, and I graduated from drinking the beer to whiskey and getting into the pain pillow and then getting into the marijuana and the other stuff like uppers and downers, cocaine, and then man, it just got so bad that after a while, I was even wrestling under the situations like that. But I guess I was dedicated enough going to the gym that I'd sweated a lot of it out, so I was able to still.
But Ivan, I heard you had like a $1,600 a week cocaine habit. Man, that's a lot of money for today, yesterday, $1,600 a week. Where were you finding this stuff? It's everywhere we go. I mean, because there's always that element around the business. To me, were you a light switch? Did you need something to take you to make you go to sleep, and then something to get you up? Because it sounds like you were in a pretty bad place.
Yeah, it was like that, but not realizing it at the time, it was felt better like that. So you just go back to doing that. Cocaine, the uppers, downers, that. I could function at it. I remember getting up and smoking marijuana and put my running stuff on and go run 3 miles, Come back and grab the crowbar and down to the pool, do some curls and some leg raises. I worked out like a maniac, stuff. If I didn't go to the gym, I'd work out like that. And after a while, it just becomes routine.
I know.
Get
yeah.
More and more involved.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Do you own a home or condo? Or perhaps you run a house or apartment? Sure you do. And Geico knows it can be hard work. Because whether you own or rent, you still have to fill it full of your stuff. Your furniture, the flat screen, and all the boxes of stuff that have been sitting there ever since you moved in, but haven't unpacked. It's hard to find the time, right? But you know what's easy? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. That way, you'll rest easy knowing that your home and all your stuff is protected. Like the furniture and that flat screen. Plus, getting a quote on homeowners and renters insurance is super easy through Geico. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. You know, like going through all those boxes of stuff. Visit geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com.
I always tell people, a lot of people, you know, back, I never really had any cocaine issues. I was more of a drinking guy, and I didn't really mess with too many pain pills, needed something to go to sleep, but I was kind of like a light switch. I needed something to make me go to sleep. I needed something to get up in the morning, and that was usually a couple of Vicodin and some coffee and a couple of pots of coffee. And I always tell people, you get into zombie mode, and so what becomes normal for us is not normal to anybody else, and it's really not normal. It shouldn't be normal for us, but that's the way we operate. But, you know, when I go back and I look at so many of your old matches, because I just followed your career for so long because I just loved your work inside the ring and loved the whole gimmick, there was no way that I would ever look at Ivan Koloff on a television screen and say, oh, this dude's out of his mind on cocaine or he's pilled up, because you always looked like you were in control and completely normal.
Yeah, as it seemed like, yeah. I could see that people looking at it that way, because that's the character I ended up becoming, I guess, you know, and it became like a real thing rather than just a persona or a gimmick type of thing. It was like talking about Buzz Sawyer. We came in, we'd go 1 week in Atlanta, 1 week in Ohio, so we'd fly to Ohio, rent a car, do the show there, wherever, Cincinnati, drive to Cleveland, do the show. I have to get back to Cincinnati or whatever to catch the flight back to Atlanta for Saturday morning TV. And you have to drive like 200 some miles back from Cleveland to Cincinnati or whatever it was. And we got in real late, different situations. Matter of fact, one situation, one time was the police with the helicopter came and pulled us over on the highway. A girl that Buzz had picked up on the mattress, and she was in the car with us. She had called her sister, and her sister called the cops and said, we won't let her out of the car. And that wasn't the case at all. Let her out of the car. When they came down and landed on the highway and stopped us, and they searched us all and all this stuff, and of course they found stuff in her. They let us go because they realized that the girl, she fessed up and said, no, my sister's crazy. She ended up calling it in. So they didn't let us go in that, but that was the situations of one time that happened. Another time we ended up showing up late for the TV and Ole wanting to find us. He was the booker there in Atlanta at the time for Jim Barnett, and he was going to find us, and everybody fined Buzz $500 for being late for TV. And then he was going to find me, and I was next, and I just said, no, well, I took my sweater off, I had a big hockey sweater on, and I says, no, you're going to have to fight me for it, Ole. I knew Ole was a tough guy, too, so I said, and I'm going to take my money with me. You're not going to take my money, because you're stealing right out of my pocket, and my family needs it. That's what I told him.
Yeah.
He just stared at me for about 30 seconds, and he said, put your coat back on, Ivan. I said, sorry, I'll hook it up, I'll fix it up. He did. When I left the dinner drawer, I guess he had taken a couple $100 off me without me knowing it. But he put it back on my check when I left, because he knew I worked real hard. But things got so bad, you know, Steve, that I ended up like going to the Middle East after wrestling Backlund. And even when I was wrestling Backlund, my knee was locking up in the ring. That's why when I came back from the Middle East. We went over there, a bunch of us, Iron Sheik and Larry Henning's son, Kurt Henning, and a bunch of guys on the plane, Fuji. And I ended up drinking my vodka on the plane, going crazy, and fight with the Iron Sheik on the plane. And he bit me on the on the neck, you know.
Now, this is a shoot fight on a commercial airliner.
Yeah.
So what are the flight attendants doing?
Panicking. When we landed in Jordan before Kuwait, the militia came on with machine guns on the plane. And
no.
Fuji had me tied in the seat by this time. And every time I'd come to and went to go after the Sheik again, he'd pull the seat cup tighter. And I had about a 30-inch waist there for one trip anyway. But he was doing it for my, you know, my own sake, keeping me.
Now, how salty was the Iron Sheik?
I seen him at Buzzwat one day in the motel room. Matter of fact, I refereed the match. I always get caught doing being the referee in street fights and all that. But he ended up, they wanted to see who was better. And we were in the motel room. And they ended up with pushing furniture back. And they went for about 20 minutes, 30 minutes.
Who did?
Wrestling. Amateur, you know. See who could pin who. And I was the referee.
Who was going back and forth?
Both of them were going back and forth. One to get one for a while, I'd go over to try to get him, and man, it was like, they should have had tickets for that. I mean, I should have had to pay a ticket for that because, I mean, they wrecked the place. TV was knocked over, and that was just one of the situations with Buzz. Another situation with Buzz was we stopped at a store after a match up in Ohio, and we ended up going in for some beer. I was ahead of him, had some pretzels and whatever. And ended up going out of the store carrying a bag, and Buzz was behind me. This guy's up had been to the matches and was out in the parking lot, and they ended up saying to me as I came out the door, "Street fight, you guys don't have a street fight? I can show you how to street fight." And I said, "Oh, is that right?" So I went to put the bag down, but I was watching the guy real close that he didn't kick me or something while I was putting the bag down. I was going to see how he could street fight, you know. I was crazy myself, so ended up, as I put the bag down, when I turned to face the guy, Buzz came out like a bulldozer, knocked the guy out to the parking lot, and picked that guy up. No kid, he was like a rag doll, that guy. Buzz was picking him up, slamming him, suplexing him, and the cop came around, jumped out of the car and had the gun on Buzz, and Buzz had him up in, I don't know, bear hug or something. Squeezed him anyway. The guy was screaming, and the cop said, "Drop that band." And Buzz dropped him, and he said, "Get your hands up," and all this stuff. And it was just like something you'd see on TV or something, you know, but it was for real. This guy was panicking to get out of there because Buzz was killing him. So Buzz could fight. He was a scrapper for sure.
But all the boys are it was kind of like the Wild Wild West back then, right?
It was. Oh, yeah.
I mean, you literally had to fight for your spot on the card.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, talk about a street fight. And I see Brian and Matt Borg went one day. And I was the referee in that, raising the bar. Went right outside. I kept refereeing it. They'd go for the eyes or something like that. No eyes, no hair. They came out of that all bloody, tore up, and oh, man.
Hey, Ivan, for sure. How was being in the ring with Andre the Giant? How strong was that guy? And how did you get along with him?
I got along real good. He really liked me, I guess because I went in there with trying to do the right thing. I was intimidated, first of all. You know, dealing with a giant and figuring you would throw him out. But the first time I got in there, I was after I won the belt, you know, up there in Montreal. And I figured, well, I'm 300 pounds, and, you know, I'm doing 500 pounds. But anyway, you start feeling, you know, trying to reason this out. Giant backed me in the corner, and I realized how big this guy was. I couldn't even see over his shoulder, like, you know, his head was still up there. He had me back in the corner, and he was, you know, with his back towards me, and he was just doing that thing where he grabs the rope. And it felt like every time he'd crunch backwards, the rope would hit me in the side and the rib and the back. It felt like something was going to break. I was saying, I was going, he was laughing. he was, Then after the match, I said to him, I said, "Andre, did you drink beer?" He says, "Yes." And I said, tonight I buy you the beer, okay? He liked that, and I was willing to buy him some beer, you know. So he never hurt me in the ring. And I always liked to go back in the ring and wrestle. In fact, one time we had to come back from Florida to wrestle him in the Coliseum in Montreal. And we even did a thing where Audrey suggested it too, where he was at the table going to sign the contract. And I picked up a chair and hit him over the head. And he went down. I was surprised. He went down and everything came up, blood all over the place. And I mean, that really made the match right there. Like, you know, to set it up for Cello for sure. But he was really nice. But you didn't want to mess with him in the ring because, you know, he could hurt you.
Could he literally do anything he wanted because he was so strong?
Yeah, he could. So big, so strong. And I mean, anything with me anyway. I guess there is some guys out there that know a lot of wrestling and they're tough guys, you know, that probably could do something with them maybe, but I just sure didn't want to try.
Hey, Ivan, you mentioned getting color when you hit Andre with that chair. I noticed, you know, when I look at you, in regards to you getting color, you seem to make a vertical cut rather than a horizontal. Why was this?
I found that, you know, for a long time there, I would end up, because it seemed like they wanted, you know, the situation every night. And, you know, when I've had an angle here with Jimmy Valiant, the Boogeyman, the Rope Warriors or whatever, you'd end up one night bleeding and the next night, you know, because you're wrestling every night, 7 days a week. And the guy just hit the same cut. Well, after I got staph infection in my head for a long time there, I was a little leery of that. But for a long time, that's what I was doing, just opening up the same cut. But I think the reason for a while there was I carried on my wrist, and then later on I carried my mouth. So in my mouth, it was easier to go, I guess, horizontal or whatever. But for a long time there, that's what I was trying to do. I was figuring that would make the matches look better. I remember one match with Bruno, the cage. I hit that cage 20 times if I didn't hit it 40 times and never did get any juice. I hit it hard. I hit it as hard as I could. I hit that cage. He threw me in the cage and I just hit it as hard as I could with my head. And next day I got up, I had scrapes all over, burns all over. And
so
bruises,
you were trying to hardwire yourself?
Yeah, that's right. That's how crazy you figured it'd look good, you know, hardly.
Hey, Ivan, going back to your first blade job, you know, when I went to pro wrestling school, I was taught by a man named Gentleman Chris Adams. They didn't teach me how to swing a steel chair. They didn't teach me how to make my own blade. It's some of those things that you learn from someone that passes it on to you. With regard to making your own blade, who was the guy? Because you don't just start making a blade because you don't know how to make one. Who taught you how to make a blade?
That'd be the guys in the gym. Yeah, there was some guys that were already training there in the gym. So the guys like Johnny Powers wasn't there then. He had already been trained and left the gym. But there was some old-timers there. Senator Clark. Let me see. I'm trying to think. The Love Brothers were going to the gym then.
But you like to carry on your wrist?
Yeah, they had me. But they just had me had it on the wrist. And the time came because they had matches at that gym every Thursday night outside. And then I'd go to the ring, right, to get it and
do it.
I mean, that was the first time. That was scary. I mean, I don't know what you do, nervous and everything. But once you did it one time, and then you were used to it. But it got better as time went on. First, I carried on my wrists and that. And then later on, it wasn't long after, I started carrying my mouth. Because I figured it was a lot easier to get to, you know. A lot of guys thought, you're crazy carrying your mouth. You want to swallow it, you know. But never did swallow it.
And, you know, Bret the Hitman Hart carried one in his mouth as well. And you never had no issues with that?
No, never did. I might have nicked myself a little bit a time or two, but nothing I can recall, not a swallowing or anything like that, you know.
I really enjoyed your tag team combination of you and Nikita. And there were so many great tag teams back in the day with, you know, the Russians and also Barry Darso would team with you on many occasions as well. But you had the Rock and Roll Express, the Midnight Express. You had the Road Warriors. You had Arn and Ole or Arn and Tully and many more. What happened to tag team wrestling? Because it's hard to beat a great tag team match when it's on the card. Because especially when you have two bona fide teams and four guys that can work their ass off, and a great referee. And I was watching some of your old matches. Tommy Young was a referee in a lot of those matches. I really loved his work. But what has happened to tag team wrestling in your estimation? Why did it disappear?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was people back in those days of wrestling was educated more to the tag team. But it seemed like it was made more on the interviews, and they kept up to it, the fan, what happened each week, and it seemed like it was a continual build-up thing because we were talking about it every week. And it seemed like every town you'd have a little bit different thing going on so that some of the fans, as they traveled, they weren't up to it. It was still related to the same guy, you know, the feud, but maybe a different type of match. And it seemed like, I don't know, if it really gotten away from that, or maybe more time was spent at it just to get that real heat going, I guess. You know, nowadays it's hard to get that heat because of, you know, wrestling being out in the open more with the fan, and I guess the fans realize that, well, these guys are just in there playing around, you know.
Right.
But they're not really playing around. That's what I try to tell them. Can you imagine going around playing around and getting dislocated shoulders and, you know, a busted neck? And
yeah, I think it's more of a how it's presented these days versus what it was in the old days. I mean, you know, back in the old days, I mean, you know, wrestling was still quote-unquote real. All of the exposés hadn't happened. And, you know, I understand that today's everything changes, but it's all in how it's presented. I wanted to talk, before we hit the go-home on this, talk about your association with Nikita Koloff, because whose idea was it to put you two guys together? Because it would later on down the road many years be Nikita Koloff make an introduction to you with someone who would basically turn your life around. So whose idea was it to put you and Nikita together as a tag team in the ring?
The first time I heard anything about it was Jim Crockett came up to me and he said, Ivan, you excelled not only in singles before, but in tag team also. How about if you got a partner, maybe like a nephew or something like that, who would be close to you, that you create like a team together? And I said, yeah, I'm all for it. Who do you got in mind? I had nobody in mind, so I went picking our brains, you know. Of course, I didn't have no relative. I had a son, but he did take up wrestling, so I said, who could it be? And Animal got into it, the Road Warriors, and he came up with Nikita because he grew up with him in Minnesota. And Nikita was a football player, collegiate, and I think with Omaha, if I'm not mistaken, and South Dakota. Anyway, he was a pretty good football player, I guess, and worked out at the gym with Animal and Hawk for a while there, coming up. And I guess Crusher was even part of that group up there, too, Crusher Christian,
yep.
Barry Darso. And ended up, anyway, picking Nikita. And when I seen him for the first time, they brought him down right away and got started with it. I said, man, this guy should be ideal. He's a college graduate. He's on the ball as far as education. You know, he looks great, you know, close to 300-pounder, obviously working out like a bodybuilder. And put him on the right road, you should be able to develop some. And I pretty well thought of it the same way as what happened to me, like, you know, let somebody else do the talk and stand there intimidating looking and just be very convincing in the ring. And that's what I was told starting off. And but Nikita did it perfect. And with him, of course, he never went to a wrestling school. So he, even though he's an athlete, we had to teach him things each day from Don Cardullo helping him, myself. You know, I guess a lot of the guys put their information in. But I try to sit down with him each day and go over one thing at least in the dressing room, standard wrist lock, a backdrop, you know, slam, or whatever it is, that's the way you do it. He'd pick up real quick. I said, now, whenever you're in public, don't be talking to people, go with the accent and all the way, and lay him in. Don't be afraid to lay it in when you're in the ring.
Like, right.
Got to make it look good in the ring because they're going to only believe what they see, you know, and if you're not experienced at it, you're going to probably be going to be able to see through unless you're real solid. He was solid, all right. He had more people, more of the boys complaining, even myself. As he came, I'd tag him, he'd come into the It's a great part of the ring, and me to come in, and that elbow of his would catch me. Oh man. And then he'd slot my hand like for a tag, and I'd be like, excel in my hand. But I do it, not only for the people, but I was doing it for the idea that he'd slap it hard. I even said to him in the dressing room, I said, Nicky, I'm your partner now. You're not supposed to kill me. You're supposed to kill the opponent. Yeah. Well, of course, I was kidding with him, but
yeah.
He gets it across to him that he was being solid, and that's what we wanted. And he'd knock, he'd put out some guy with that sickle clothesline, and the guy would do a whole backflip, like a, I guess, a one and a half.
Yeah.
And when I see one of the monkeys do that, I said, oh, my. You must have heard it, but the Balkans, I guess, just went with it, I guess, the force of it knocked him over. But, yeah, Nicky was real good like that, catching on to stuff and keeping the accent when he was out there. And it paid off because they really believed in you could do it because we had that big memorial show at Memorial Park there in Charlotte. There were over 30,000 people. And Flair flew in on the helicopter that night. Man, I could tell by the crowd that they wanted to see something there. Was Flair against Nikita, and I think we were against Road Warriors being the Crusher, and that was good. Well, of course, the Four Horsemen were out there too, Dusty and all them. So he had a good card for sure, but they really could tell the people were riot. Whenever somebody runs in the ring, tries to get Nikita before the match even starts, you know that they're pretty hot at it.
You just named a lot of Nikita, big names
there. My life, but, you know, and I think it was God ordained, well, let's put the keys in there, knowing that I'd need to have some help, somebody with some credibility with me to reach me. Because after I quit in 89, then the keys knew from 83 to 89, like, you know, six years being together, that, I had a little trouble with the drugs and the alcohol. And matter of fact, I quit with the idea of really settling down, trying to get off of this stuff and clean up my situation here and make me wrestle better, heal up a bit. But I ended up throwing the stuff away, going back to even at a wrestling school for a while there for 4 or 5 years. And, after that, I just get to the point that I just keep going back to it. So I, of course, couldn't afford cocaine anymore, so I was able to get out of that. But ended up, Nikita called me one day, and he said to me on the phone, you got my attention. He said he wanted to invite me to come to the church, that he had become a born-again Christian. And he said, I know what you need in your life, Uncle. You need Jesus in your life. And I said, what are you talking about, Nicky? I was raised in the Catholic Church. I went to church every week, and I know who Jesus is. He said, it's not that. He said, the devil knows who Jesus is, too, but that doesn't make him a Christian. So he got my attention. I said, so I ended up going to that church, but by looking for that help, that I needed to get off the drugs. And, I got it all right because this little Catholic boy found himself on his butt when the service was over because the Lord touched me in such a way, I ended up being overtaken by the Spirit, is the way I understand it. And, I mean, I went down the fastest I've ever done in my life. I thought maybe it was somebody like Andre the Giant clotheslined me, but it was so gentle. When I landed, I just hurt myself or nothing, and I was, like, down, and I felt real good. And I went to jump up because wrestling worked out, I guess, I have it. And Nikita grabbed me, and he says, relax, that's the Holy Spirit. And, man, I realized it had to be God because I had no way I went down in front of all those people, like that. Because I even said that to myself, seeing people before go down, and said it must be that they're paid to do that or something. What they're saying is by me receiving Christ, my old debt was paid, all that crazy stuff I did, forgiven of it, and anything I do in the future, if I keep him as my taking partner, more or less to say, that I'd be able to overcome anything, and he'd never leave me or forsake me.
It wasn't an immediate cure for your addiction, though. So how did you stay with the process to... I would imagine you're 100% clean right now, correct?
Yes, sir. Yep.
Sure. So how long did it take you? Because the cocaine, you got rid of that, then you started leaning on the marijuana, you started going to the chewing tobacco. That's not illegal, but you needed a crutch. And so what was the weaning off process for you? Did you do it yourself? Did you go to a drug rehab place?
No drug rehab. No, and that's what's really surprising about the whole thing. I know there's some people that went right from receiving Christ to quit smoking and doing all the other stuff. With me, it was a process. I was told it was important to get into the Word, that by taking into the Word of God, the Bible, and reading it, I end up taking in the Word, and it pushes out all the other junk. And what happens is, over a period of time, your faith grows to the period that God blesses you enough to be able to quit this stuff. So it gives you the strength to be able to quit it. So what happened with me was the chewing tobacco went real quick. And I must say, I was fighting a bit there for a while with the beer and that. But it wasn't long, just a few months type thing, and everything went away. Because I said to myself, and I believed the fact of what they had told me, and I just went with that and kept asking God for help. And man, I just started throwing the stuff away. The marijuana and that just went one day, just like I don't want it no more. The cocaine I wasn't involved in with anymore. And that was different than what I was doing just a year before that or 6 months before that. I was throwing it away, but I'd be going back and taking it back. And now I wasn't doing that. So I figured that God was working in my life and let me have the strength to be able to overcome this. So it's pretty hard to deny. And then whenever you start getting this kind of help, you know.
So now you're an ordained minister. And yes, you do a lot of work with the Children's Miracle Network.
Yeah, I just did one last night. If I run out of a place to go, I'll go in any place. And whether it's a food store or Walmart, Kmart, whatever, they've all allowed me in at one time or another. And the people really respond good, because they just end up doing some good cause, and that I'm doing it for a good reason. And man, they're really kind about it. The stores all do campaigns like that to raise money for these good causes, and I'm all for it. It keeps me occupied, busy, and feel like you're somewhat worthy of doing something, because you went through this career of being noticed, and now all of a sudden you're stuck at home. What are you going to do? Be a couch potato or get out there and, you know, do something useful? And I feel like by getting out and, you know, talking to kids and encouraging kids, because you don't know how much that touches kids. Well, you probably do yourself, you know, Steve, because you, you know, been a big star too. And whenever you tell a kid, man, I believe someday you're going to be a famous guy. You know, you're a great athlete, aren't you? What that you instill in that kid, he's going to take that home. And he's going to end up, you know, thinking of that and reacting to that time and time again over his lifetime. Because that's what my mom said to me too. When I came home and told her I want to be a wrestler at 18 years old, she says, you can do it. Every time she sees me, she says, there's my little champ. He's going to be a wrestling champ one day. And that always stuck with me. So now I try to tell other kids, you know, try to tell them, find out what they're interested in. And tell them, you can do it. You can do it. I'll be looking for you, you know. And that I think really instill kids and helps them to dream, you know.
Ivan, you have your website, IvanKoloff.com, and you're on Twitter, IKoloff. You got anything coming up that you want to plug? Anything else that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I ended up, you know, fans being so nice and different people pulling together for, just did a, matter of fact, coming out in January, I believe he said the documentary would be ready, that a lot of fans had a part in, not only raising money to put the documentary together to a friend, Michael Elliott, into the Charlotte area, but he's going to be coming out in January with that. I'll have it on my site, and he'll have it on his site too, Elbow Press, I think is his name of his company type thing. And also they can go to my author of my book that you mentioned earlier, Is That Wrestling Fake? The Bare Facts by Ivan Koloff. Scott Teal is the author. He's done several books on different guys. At his is crowbarpress.com. And I got Facebooks and all that stuff. But and my daughter is a gospel singer, and she is great. She's got her baby singing with her sometimes. Their group is called Highway Revival. Of course, my book is crowbarpress.com. And check out my site if you would, folks. It's IvanKoloff.com, and got my different stuff on there from pictures and all that. And it really helps if you feel like you'd like to donate to my ministry. Just go up to ivankolov.com, and PayPal is hooked up to that, or just send it to my address there and there. That would be a big help. I really appreciate you folks over the years, Ben, and look forward to hearing this play back to you.
Ivan, it was good talking to you. I'm a big fan of your work, and glad to hear you're doing good. And we'll see one of these days about getting that hip fixed, kid.
Yeah, but my big thing now is I want to see Vince, who used me in the Hall of Fame there. I want to get there and say hello to all my friends before I hang it up here. No, I'm still good for a few miles yet, but I guess I wouldn't be good in the ring, but unless I had an awful weak opponent. But I was trying to get a hold of the office up there, you know, Steve, because I had a suggestion for the Russian guy. I really think they put a lot of stuff on him, a lot of heat on him. But I can't get nobody to call me back.
There's been several Russians throughout the history of our illustrious business of professional wrestling, which they now call sports entertainment. What are your thoughts on the sports entertainment?
Yeah, I really like it. The idea that now they're able to do something. I really thought at first it was they were making a big mistake at having, you know, more or less go show business with it, like out there to the people. But I really think that Vince has got something there. It's just the idea of keeping it. Interest up. Everybody could be critical of stuff and find fault with it, but to me, whenever you got guys that athletes like these got out there doing the stuff they're doing today, man, it's hard to dox guys that such great shape and work so hard, you know, got to be getting hurt.
What do you like about this Rusev kid?
Yeah, I think he's good. And he's a good size guy, and I like the stuff he does, man. He's able to kick the guy right in the face.
Yep. He's good. I think the girl adds a lot to him. I think he's very aggressive, powerful. He's not trying to say too much on his promos. They're very simple. I like the kid a lot. He's still got a long ways to go. He's relatively green, but I think he's going to be a big star.
Yeah, I'd like to suggest something for him up there that I think would work good as a finishing thing for him. And it's got to talk to the right guys, you know, about introducing him.
Well, if anybody would know, it would be you, who had tremendous success as a Russian coming from Canada. But I'll pass along the thought that you're trying to reach out to them, and we'll see if we can hook you guys up.
Yeah, I think I just want them to listen. If they say no good, fine. But I don't want to just talk to anybody up there, you know. I wanted to talk to somebody that, you know, that hurt the business and that thing.
Well, all right, Ivan, I appreciate your time. It was great talking to you.
You too, Steve. God bless you, brother. Merry Christmas to you and yours.
Merry Christmas to you.
I hope to get to see you here in the future.
One of these days, that'd be great to shake your hand. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. God bless you. Bye-bye.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
All this month, stream the funniest films for free on Pluto TV. Watch comedy classics like Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, and Mean Girls. Or drop in for a Tyler Perry marathon with a Madea family funeral and Madea's witness protection. Pluto TV also has hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and TV shows like Get Shorty, Be Cool, Key and Peele, Comedy in Color, and more. And no contracts, no subscriptions, no fees, no joke. So download the Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device and start laughing today. Pluto TV, drop in, watch free.
Hey sports fans, it's Chris Howard, former Jacksonville Jaguar running back and 1997 National Championship running back from the University of Michigan. Get plugged in with me every week as I'll be breaking down the biggest topics in the world of sports and entertainment. Join me and my special guests for some honest conversations about sports and life when the cameras are no longer flashing. I'll also be breaking down weekly matchups for NFL and college football games. Be in the know, listen to, and follow Plugged In with Chris Howard now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.